Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the failure of recent efforts to broker a ceasefire agreement between Israelis and Palestinians. Michael Bruhn of the Rainforest Action Network, who describes a campaign funded by oil, timber, and tobacco companies to revoke his environmental group's tax-exempt status. And hospital worker Peg Temelevich, who discusses the unique struggle for unionization among her fellow employees at Yale New Haven Hospital. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that the Bush administration is working overtime on a tried-and-true political strategy: divide the Democrats to win the next election. In preparing its national energy strategy, top Bush aides made a major overture to more conservative trade unions with a potential payoff of creating more construction jobs. This effort got the attention of Teamsters President James Hoffa, who met in May with Vice President Dick Cheney and Karl Rove. Hoffa, in turn, backed the call to drill for more oil and natural gas. Hoffa, who endorsed Al Gore in the 2000 election, stated, "The creation of jobs for Teamsters members can make for some strange bedfellows, but it is a bed we can lie in if it keeps our members working." Politically, the Bush team is working to break up the Teamster Turtle Alliance that grew out of the globalization protest in Seattle against the World Trade Organization. That same coalition helped prevent former President Clinton from winning fast-track trade negotiating authority. So far, congressional Democrats have not countered the GOP by proposing any new public works projects, but some members of the Progressive Caucus are pushing for tax credits for energy-efficient cars made by union labor. But how the so-called energy crisis plays out politically is still unknown. As independent Vermont Congressman Bernie Sanders observed, "If you go out and listen to people, there is plenty of anger at the energy companies, and there's a great deal of support for a windfall profits tax." Preparing for its second generation of oil exploration, the poor South American country of Ecuador is looking to cash in on its natural resources. The national government is in the process of opening up 5 million acres of Amazon rainforest to drilling by oil giant Occidental Petroleum. The government is also putting out bids for construction of a new oil pipeline with the capacity to carry 45,000 barrels of crude oil a day. According to the New Internationalist magazine, oil production has for years been a disaster for Ecuador's economy, ecology, and native peoples. Since Texaco won drilling rights in the late 1960s, the nation's poverty rate grew by 20%, and underemployment grew by nearly 500%. Meanwhile, Texaco was given a free pass into the Oriente, the eastern end of the Amazon rainforest. In over 20 years, Texaco pumped out 3 billion barrels of crude oil and helped enrich the military elite. The oil boom contributed to making Ecuador one of the world's most corrupt and economically polarized countries. Texaco also dumped an estimated 4 million gallons of toxic metals, which ran into open pits polluting local streams and rivers. A recent break in the first oil pipeline used by Texaco led to an oil spill and fire near the town of Papallacta, the source of half of the drinking water for Quito, Ecuador's capital city. To avoid more oil-driven corruption and pollution, Ecuadorian environmentalists, in their efforts to curtail further oil exploitation, want to expand the local ecotourism industry that has recently taken off. Norm Crosty, an electrician at a Ford assembly plant in Michigan, sent a letter in October 1998 to the local labor relations office to complain that he was having trouble doing his job properly because his supervisors took tools home to work on side projects. Instead of launching an investigation, Ford banned Crosty from the factory, citing the auto giant's anti-violence policy, and ordered Crosty to see a Ford-contracted psychiatrist or lose his job. According to the Progressive magazine, Crosty is among a growing number of corporate whistleblowers and union activists who are subjected to psychological exams as a way to discredit workplace dissenters. The U.S. Postal Service has gone one step further by giving line supervisors the power to order an emergency psychiatric exam for any postal employee who appears argumentative. Steve Albanese, a business agent with the American Postal Workers Union, says this new policy targets local shop stewards, who, as part of their jobs, sometimes need to challenge local managers to defend the rights of union members on the job. Donald Serkin, a former psychiatric social worker with the U.S. Public Health Service, questions the need for fitness for duty psych exams. He told the Progressive magazine, "What they're trying to do is put a person on psychiatric disability. If they succeed, that person will never work again." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Despite a new round of shuttle diplomacy by Secretary of State Colin Powell to establish a ceasefire between Israelis and Palestinians, the effort has thus far failed. As car bombings and sniper attacks continue to claim new victims on both sides, the death toll rises daily, with more than 500 mostly Arab deaths in this latest Palestinian intifada or uprising. Meanwhile, human rights groups are condemning the Israeli military's targeting of Palestinians for assassination. The latest incident occurred on June 24th, when a leader of the Fatah movement was killed after a bomb exploded in a phone booth he was using. More recently, on July 1st, IDF helicopters fired missiles at a car killing three, which Israeli officials claim prevented a terrorist attack. According to Palestinian human rights groups, 25 Palestinian militants, including six bystanders, have been killed by special Israeli military units since November. While the government has not admitted its role in the killings, Israeli officials often identify the victims of such murders as security threats. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the obstacles standing in the way of achieving a ceasefire.
Clearly, there is no ceasefire underway. What is underway is a continuing escalation of the conditions in which Israel's ongoing occupation is being imposed, is being implemented. That means that settlement construction is going ahead with both the construction of new outposts that are called parts of existing settlements, and the great term thickening is coming back into vogue, the thickening of existing settlements, meaning building new houses, that sort of thing. The claim made by Sharon is that these new construction projects are only designed to take into account the so-called natural growth in the settlements, which, as far as I could tell, must mean that in Sharon's view, the settlers are doing nothing but breeding like rabbits, that they need so many new houses out there when so many settlement apartments are actually empty. So this is all sort of underway now with very little attention by the United States, except to accept, as Colin Powell did during his recent visit to the region, the Israeli claim that Israel alone has the right to determine when 1 day or ultimately 7 days without violence has occurred, that there will be no international observers to monitor such a ceasefire. And according to Sharon's version of the so-called Mitchell Report, the plan that was put forward by former U.S. Senator George Mitchell and endorsed by the United States and both the Israeli and Palestinian negotiating teams, the definition of or interpretation of Mitchell that's being used by Sharon and accepted by the U.S. says that first there must be this 7 days of absolute calm, then a six-week cooling-off period, and only then the beginning of what are known as confidence-building measures, which is the first time that Israel will be obligated to do anything, in that case, a settlement freeze. But, on the other hand, Sharon has said from the beginning that while Israel accepts the Mitchell recommendations with reservations, one of his reservations is that he absolutely refuses to accept a settlement freeze. So the whole notion of what the Palestinians are supposed to get after this 7 day of calm and then 6 weeks of cooling off is very unclear, because the one thing that made sense out of the Mitchell report, the need for a settlement freeze, has been dismissed by Israel, and the U.S. has said nothing about that rejection.
What is the incentive in your mind for the Israeli side to agree to a ceasefire or observe that a ceasefire has been put in force by the Palestinian side, given Ariel Sharon's resistance to a freeze on settlements, as you said, and his resistance to final status peace negotiations?
Well, I think we have to distinguish here, Scott, between what ordinary Israelis might want in terms of a ceasefire and what the Israeli policy is. I have no doubt that ordinary Israelis who have suffered from terrible attacks on civilians, most notably the suicide bombing of the disco in Tel Aviv with the deaths of 21 young Israelis, many of them teenagers. This is a horrifying reality for Israel, and I have no doubt that most Israelis want that to end and want a ceasefire in a very real and urgent sense. On the other hand, I think it's quite clear that it's at least questionable, at best questionable, whether Ariel Sharon and his cabinet in fact want a ceasefire at all. Because if there is a ceasefire and it was successful, and then there were to be a six-week so-called cooling-off period and it were successful, then, God forbid, the Israelis might actually have to negotiate back on serious political issues that have to do with ending the occupation. And there's absolutely no indication so far, in fact, every indication is to the contrary, that Israel has any intention of negotiating anything that even resembles an end to the occupation. Sharon's own position, of course, is that so-called final status issues, such as the right to return of Palestinian refugees, the status of Jerusalem, the fate of the Israeli settlers, and the ultimate borders of a Palestinian state, and therefore the borders of Israel, which, of course, has never declared its borders, that those issues are no longer on the table. He's not prepared to negotiate on those issues at any time in the foreseeable future. All he is prepared to negotiate on is some version of a permanent temporary status. It's an anomalous situation, but I think what he's really looking for is some version of the Oslo-era in-between status, the not-so-permanent decisions on things like dealing with the roads and dealing with closures and dealing with economic issues, but not dealing with any of the final status issues, and seeing that as the permanent reality for the next decade or more.
Phyllis, what are the consequences, in your mind, of a continued stalemate and the continuing violence?
Number one, we're going to see an awful lot of people killed, maimed, injured, scarred for life physically, psychologically, emotionally, socially, and in every other way. The vast majority of those people are going to be Palestinians.
That was Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382. Or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. For more than a decade, the Rainforest Action Network has successfully been fighting to protect forests in North America and around the world. Employing nonviolent civil disobedience, consumer boycotts, and other media-savvy actions, the environmental group has recently won significant victories, including an agreement to preserve a large section of British Columbia's Great Bear Rainforest and pressuring Home Depot to stop buying wood made with old-growth forest lumber. But because of its success, Rainforest Action Network is now under attack by the Frontiers of Freedom Foundation, a group headed by former Wyoming Senator Malcolm Wallop, a good friend of Vice President Dick Cheney, and funded by oil, tobacco, and timber company money. Frontiers of Freedom has asked the IRS to revoke Rainforest Action's 501c3 federal tax-exempt status for what they say are the group's use of tax-deductible contributions to fund its advocacy campaigns. Frontiers of Freedom and Boise Cascade, one of the world's largest lumber companies, are both working with the Conservative Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise to target Rainforest Action. If the IRS revokes the environmental group's tax status, Frontiers of Freedom promises to challenge other progressive activist organizations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Bruhn, campaign director with the Rainforest Action Network, who discusses why his group is under attack and what's at stake in this case for free speech and democracy.
For the past few years, RAN has been running an old growth campaign in which we've been targeting the top wood and paper retailers who are using old growth wood products from around the world. And we've been having a fair amount of success in that we've helped to convince companies like Home Depot and Lowe's and Kinko's and some of the world's largest wood and paper users to agree to phase out wood products from any old growth forest around the world. And that work is starting to have an impact. We have been in negotiations with logging companies up in British Columbia, for example, and have been able, with other environmental groups, to secure protection for about 3.5 million acres of ancient forests up in BC. Here in the U.S., it's a different story. We're working targeting companies like Boise Cascade and Weyerhaeuser and International Paper and others, and they're beginning to fight back. This latest bit is a bit of a smear campaign coordinated by Boise Cascade, who, if you remember, was one of the companies that led the charge to overturn the Roadless Initiative a few months ago.
Tell us a little bit about the Frontiers of Freedom Institute and the other groups that have joined in the strategy to apparently harm environmental groups by challenging their tax-exempt status.
Right. Well, there's a term for them, and they're part of a collection of organizations in the Wise Use Movement. Wise Use Movement was founded more than a decade ago by timber industry and oil industry, ranching, and many resource extraction companies, primarily in the West, to combat environmentalism. The Frontiers of Freedom labels itself the antithesis of the environmental movement. And one of the leaders of a sister group, which is known as the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, is Ron Arnold, who's been quoted as saying, "We want to destroy environmentalism and environmentalists by taking away their money and their members." So what we see here is, to the degree to which environmental groups or social justice groups are effective at beginning to change the way in which corporations are doing business, those corporations will fight back, either directly, as we see in the case of Boise Cascade, or indirectly through front groups such as the Frontiers of Freedom.
What's the situation, as far as you see it, in terms of a precedent here? And do you feel that you are a test case? Do you feel that what happens in the campaign against the Rainforest Action Network will affect other environmental groups? Is that the feeling in the environmental movement generally, that they're sort of testing the waters here?
Oh, absolutely. It's not just the environmental movement. It's a whole host of social justice groups, or really any group that's working for social change. Since this is coming from companies on the right, I think that those who are most exposed would be environmental groups or social justice groups, human rights organizations, women's organizations, etc. And they have been very explicit and very public, actually, in identifying this as a test case. And they have said in, for example, the Wall Street Journal, that if this is successful, if they're able to take away RAND's charitable status, they'll move on to other environmental groups.
Michael Brune, from the point of view of these organizations that are trying to discredit and undermine the environmental movement, even if they're unsuccessful in revoking the Rainforest Action Network's tax-exempt status, they will certainly have distracted you with the money that you'll put into your legal defense. They've also very blatantly said they hope to scare away your funders. Maybe you could speak to that, how that's turned out so far.
It may pose a threat in 6 months or in the long term. That, I think, is quite true. We'll see how the IRS plays it. In the short term, however, and maybe at least until then, this has been one of the biggest galvanizing forces in our campaigns in recent years. I think what's happening is that many people are having a gut level, a visceral reaction to these attacks, from whether it's from the timber industry or Boise Cascade or from these front groups. You know, most folks understand what's happening out in the world. So there have just been a couple polls in the last few weeks. 75% of people, even in the Pacific Northwest, oppose old-growth logging, reported in the Portland Oregonian last week. LA Times has said that 9 out of 10 people want wilderness protected. So Boise Cascade or the Frontiers of Freedom, they find that they can't attack our ideas. They certainly can't attack our campaigns. So they're going after our funding, and I think it's going to backfire. So from our expectation is that we don't think this issue will amount to anything. We think, in fact, that it will blow over and probably won't even be addressed by the IRS. And if it does, we're very well equipped to handle it. The biggest problem that we've been dealing with for the past 2 weeks is an inundation of offers of help from tax accountants and lawyers from across the country. So we're ready to go.
That was Michael Bruhn, campaign director with the Rainforest Action Network. Contact the network by calling area code 1-800-989-RAIN or visit their website at www.ran.org. For the past 2 years, the National Hospital Workers Union 1199 has been organizing 1,700 service and clerical workers at Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut. The issues are the same as at other hospitals around the U.S., low wages, inadequate staffing, and substandard health benefits. But the organizing drive in New Haven is unique because the hospital workers have joined with Yale University's clerical, dining hall, maintenance workers, and a still unrecognized graduate student employees union, Locals 34, 35, and GISO, to form the Federation of Hospital and University Employees. Those three groups number 6,000 members. The Federation is calling for Yale New Haven's administration to remain neutral during the organizing drive, allowing the workers in the potential bargaining unit to decide whether or not to back the union by signing membership cards. If a majority of workers sign, the hospital would be bound to negotiate a contract. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Yale New Haven hospital worker and union supporter Peg Tamilevich about the working conditions which sparked the union drive and the impact the unified labor movement at Yale has had on the effort.
Staffing issues, salary issues, pension, how much we have to pay for our medical benefits, which are cut off after you retire. And as everybody knows, insurance is very, very expensive. And at that age, I just think it's a sin that you work 40 years at the hospital and then all of a sudden you can't even go to the hospital for your health care. Salaries, I don't feel, are competitive with the real world. I mean, $850 entry level, I just think is way too low for the job responsibilities.
Working Mother magazine honored Yale New Haven Hospital as one of the top 100 hospitals for working mothers, and apparently you didn't agree with that. Tell us about your reaction.
I really objected to that because we felt that that was not really valid. The daycare at the hospital is too high-priced for the regular service and clerical workers to afford. And we all filled out this big survey, and, you know, months later they announced, oh, we're going to have a daycare. And then when the price list came out, we were like, oh, well, that eliminates any possibility of us sending our kids there. Just recently contacted them and for their pricing, and it's $202 a week for the infant toddler program. And when you add that all up, that comes to $10,500 a year. Now, an entry-level employee coming into the service and clerical areas at Yale starts at approximately $850 an hour, and that only makes you $17,000 a year. So you cannot be giving $10,000 to a daycare and have, what, $7,000 to live on? We feel it's more of a daycare for the professional elite of Yale, their management staff, department heads, and that's it. You were just cut out. There was other issues that they were raving about there. Flex time, which I don't know who has that. It's a very small amount of people that have that. Majority of workers do not have flex time. That was also in the article. We're penalized for tardiness, even if it's because we have sick children, late school buses or anything like that. You're penalized for being late. If you take a day off because your child's sick, that's considered unscheduled, and that's held against you on your yearly merit review, and that can affect the amount of raises you might get.
So what can you say about the networking or collaboration between 1199, which is organizing at the hospital, and the other Yale unions, Local 34, Local 35, and GISO, which represents the graduate teachers there?
Well, we have United Together, which I think is excellent. We are so thrilled that they've stood up for us and are willing to stand up with us as we're willing to stand up with them. Yale University is a huge corporation, which we are part of that umbrella, even though they try to distinguish that it's two separate things, Yale University and Yale New Haven Hospital, but they really aren't. They're one corporation where Board of Trustee members are, you know, from the hospital around that Yale's board and vice versa, so it's all one big thing. And they employ about 25% of the population of New Haven. So for us to unite with 34 and Local 35 has been excellent. They've been to our rallies. They're supporting us because there is strength in numbers. If we unionize and get unionized along with the GSO, the graduate students, there will be approximately 8,000 workers there. We will have a bigger voice and more strength to help us with our contracts and things.
And what are you asking Yale to do regarding the union?
Well, we're seeking neutrality and car check right now.
Can you explain, how does that differ from just a National Labor Relations Board supervised union election?
Well, the problem with the National Labor Board asking for the secret ballot type deal is that's because you get lawyers involved in this deal, and this can just get postponed and delayed for years down the road. And we really don't want to get into that. We want to be able to present a majority of signed cards, have the hospital recognize that and accept that. We feel it's the least disruptive way of organizing a union. We really want to do it, you know, more quickly. We don't want to have all these delays, because the longer this is delayed, it just gives the hospital more time to use their tactics, which they've used all along, even though they deny it, of intimidation and threatening employees and working, you know, they have all the power right now. We don't have any power. I personally was threatened for handling out leaflets. I was threatened on several occasions, guaranteed I would be arrested if I continued to do that, even though, according to the National Labor Board, we have every right to be there. And we did get an agreement signed by the hospital finally after they filed charges against the hospital that we did have the right to do those things. We need this now. It's going on too long already. People are not paid enough money. They cannot afford medical benefits for their families. Just people that work at the hospital don't have medical coverage because it's too expensive and they can't afford it. There's a lot of single mothers with several children. It's just, it's not right. We need to be paid a fair salary for what we're doing.
That was Peg Timilevich, a member of the organizing committee of the Federation of Hospital and University Employees. The Federation can be contacted at area code 203-624-5161 or visit their website at www.yaleunions.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.